Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The start of the school year is overdue for many families, especially when distance learning fell short or just didn't work for some families. We're still learning the impact of learning loss and mental health on children over the past 18 months and counting. But the return to the classroom is also creating another risk. Just days or weeks into the school year, children are contracting COVID-19 and bringing it home, in some cases leading to breakthrough infections, vaccinated parents becoming sick. Leslie McClurg is a health reporter for KQED in the Bay Area. Her recent report followed a handful of families in Northern California who dealt with this new reality during the pandemic. She joins us now with her reporting. Welcome to Insight and welcome back to CAP Radio Airwaves, Leslie.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, before we listen to families that you spoke with, I mean, this was a concern going into the school year. But given that, what surprised you most in your reporting?
I think I was struck by a few things, but each family kind of taught me a little bit of a lesson. You know, first of all, I'm a mother. I've reported on this for the last year and a half, and over on air, I have said little kids, especially those under 12, generally don't get very sick. You know, maybe they'll get a sniffle, maybe they'll get a cough, but they generally aren't going to end up, you know, sick in bed with flu-like symptoms. And what I learned by talking to two of the families that I profiled was that little kids can get pretty sick, and the Delta variant seems to, we don't really have hard data showing this yet, but seems to make kids a little bit sicker than in the past. You know, these families did not end up in the hospital, but the kids got nasty coughs. Their fevers were, you know, over 104. They were laid up in bed. This was a 2-year-old and an 11-year-old. So it was a bit of a sobering reminder that COVID is even dangerous for little kids. And also a bit of a window for me into, you know, like I said, I have a little one. And now that kids are getting this and potentially getting pretty sick from this, I did learn that it could be a bit of a rocky road and a bit of a chaotic fall for parents, because one of these families, even though the kid didn't get very sick, you know, it was quite a ride for this family in terms of isolating and having to juggle childcare and work, et cetera. So I think all of it was just a bit of a, okay, we're in for what could be a bit of a rough fall.
You know, and I know that you spoke with multiple families, and it is early on in the school year, so we don't have a lot of hard data, but what data were you actually able to find to quantify this issue?
Yeah, so again, a bit of a sobering dig into the numbers. So last week alone, there were more than 180,000 pediatric cases in the U.S. The week before, 121,000 pediatric cases. This is according to the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. So week over week, just in 1 week, there was more than a 30% increase in the number of kids testing positive. And here in Oakland, we saw how that's playing out on the ground. In Oakland Unified School District, you know, in the first week of classes, 58 students tested positive and 10 staff members. And so we're like, okay, this really is gonna happen. And in Los Angeles, for example, you know, more than 3,000 kids tested positive in the 2 weeks leading up to class. So it was just all, I say all those numbers, but basically we just learned kids are getting it, they're transmitting it, and at higher numbers than we thought.
Yeah. And as a consequence of that, you actually spoke to families who went through it and dealt with it. One of the families you spoke with is Stephanie Chenard. Just catch us up on her story and her family's story.
Right. So this was a couple and their 8-year-old son. The couple, the mom and dad, were vaccinated. They live here in Alameda County, or in Alameda, excuse me. And Desmond is an 8-year-old, and he caught it from a friend, playing with a friend. And this is a family who has taken the virus very seriously from the beginning. They followed all the public health protocols and wear their masks and wash, et cetera, and wash their hands, and really try to stay as careful as possible. And so Desmond has learned over the last couple of years that the coronavirus is a scary thing and not something that you want. And so when Stephanie, you know, shared the news that he tested positive, it was pretty devastating.
So when I told him, I said, you know, sweetheart, you have COVID, he just burst out into tears.
And you know, it was also really challenging for her, because even though, I mean, the good news is, he didn't actually get very sick. He did get a fever, but it was gone within a day. And one of my favorite comments from her was, you know, he got sick for 8 hours, but I spent 45 hours on notifications alone. Because think, if your kid catches COVID, she had to call the public pool where they had just gone. She had to notify the organizers of a summer music festival. And she said one of the hardest calls that she had to make was to a good friend of hers who had just had an organ transplant. And so by the end of the day, she said, you know, it felt like a bit of a moral failing for her and her family that her son had caught COVID. So they didn't get really sick. Luckily, neither parent, there wasn't a breakthrough case in this situation, but their lives were totally upended. And she was very embarrassed. You know, they had to isolate, they had to tell all their neighbors, they couldn't leave the house. So it was challenging situation, shall we say.
Yeah. And I think it just really hits home when you live through, you know, if one person gets sick, how many people you come into contact with, and you know, and when you do your due diligence just to, you know, let people know that they have been exposed. That's also great that Stephanie and her husband didn't get sick because they were vaccinated. So it worked despite that being exposed to their son. But, you know, when reading your article, that wasn't the case for every family, particularly the Garcia family, if you can catch us up on them.
Right. And so the Garcia family may be an example of when these breakthrough cases are more common. You know, as I just said, Desmond, the 8-year-old, did not get very sick. So he probably didn't have a viral load for very long. And so that potentially protected his parents. But in the case of the Garcia family there in Sacramento, Jace did get pretty sick. He caught it from a friend playing soccer. And when he started to get his symptoms, they hit very suddenly. And I'll let him describe it because he's a pretty articulate 11-year-old.
My name is Jace Garcia, and I'm 11 years old. I've never felt anything like this. Everything was feeling like something was just squeezing that part of the body towards the bone. And then every time I would click down, I would get like a tingling sensation in my hand. I'm like, I want to go back to sleep. My hands are starting to hurt. I'm getting a little dizzy. You can't really breathe. I can't feel like I can get better.
Jace and his father actually described it as feeling really helpless because basically you've got a kid with a really high fever who's vomiting, who can't breathe, who can't really find relief in that soundbite you heard there. You know, he was talking about trying to play video games and his hands hurt too much to even hold the controller. And so it was a very scary situation. And of course, they're calling the doctor asking for help. What should we do? What should we do? And the doctor is basically saying, rest and try to stay hydrated. There's not a lot you can do for the coronavirus. And so you just kind of have to wait it out. And Rico was pretty scared. His dad, Jace's dad, is named Rico, watching his son be pretty sick. And unfortunately, he tested every single morning, and each morning he was negative. But then on the fourth morning, he tested positive for the coronavirus as well. He and his ex-wife ended up getting it as well. And they both got pretty sick. You know, they had kind of what they called severe sinus infections, feeling, you know, stuffed up, headachey. He ended up losing his voice, and he did end up getting the kind of paramount symptom of the coronavirus. Here he is describing that.
My first sip of coffee was amazing. My 9th or 10th sip tasted like hot water. I mean, it was just the snap of a finger and my sense of taste and smell was gone. I went as far as to cut a lime open and bite into it. Tasted nothing. So
it was a bit of a rough ride for both of them. You know, they both had, they were both sick for Jace for over a week, and Rico's wife, himself and his wife, were sick for, you know, 4 or 5 days, you know, pretty sick, couldn't go to work, etc.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Leslie McClurg with KQED about a recent reporting on families dealing with children bringing home COVID-19 from school. When you're talking about fevers, I mean, reading your article, I mean, these fevers are like 102 and 104 in some cases for these children. And we recently actually on Insight discussed the rise in pediatric COVID infections at hospitals here in Sacramento. But relatively speaking, what were you able to gather when it comes to the threat of the virus to children?
Yeah, I definitely want to underscore that these are sounds kind of scary the way that Jace described his symptoms, but none of these kids required hospitalization. And that is by and far the case for the majority of kids who are catching this. We know kids get it. We know that they're getting it a lot more frequently because the Delta variant is more contagious, but it's extremely rare to end up in the hospital. So in some states where they are collecting data, it's like fewer than 2% of all pediatric COVID-19 cases require hospitalization. And fortunately, fewer than, I think it's 0.03% are fatal. So it's very, very different for kids than it is for adults still.
Yeah, and that brings up another issue. On the flip side, you know, the toll on a child's mental health has created its own dire health situation for so many families during this time.
Yeah, I think it was extremely sobering for teachers, for parents, for public health officials to see how challenging it was on children, remote learning. And that wasn't all kids. Some kids loved it and thrived. But overall, I think it's fair to say that we saw a lot more depression and anxiety in kids. It's hard on all of us to be isolated. It's especially hard, I think, on kids who really thrive on a lot of social interaction. And I think that the hard stat that we can kind of point to reflect last year is that emergency departments did see a spike in visits from kids for mental health issues. So we know it was hard, really hard on some kids. And so public health officials are pushing really hard to try to keep kids in school right now and keep schools open, even with the Delta variant spiking. Mostly because, you know, it's not only academics, but it's like all these things I've talked about in terms of socializing. It's art class, it's drama, it's band practice, it's access to medical and mental health services. Sometimes it's a place to get lunch for low-income kids. So school is a sanctuary for a lot of kids. And so they really are trying to keep them open and balance the situation, try to find a way to keep kids in class safely with, you know, ventilation, with masking, with vaccinating teachers, et cetera.
And this really just adds just another layer of complexity to a challenge of education during this time. I mean, as we've learned, some children thrive during remote learning, other children fell behind, and there's that real risk of learning loss. We're also talking about mental health. And then on the flip side, you know, you spoke with some young children who ended up getting sick when they went back to school. It's so unique to each family and to each child. What's the right way to weigh the risks?
I asked so many public health officials, teachers, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, and I was like, how should families do this? What kind of useful information can I possibly offer families? And you kind of said it. There is no magic solution for any particular family. I think each family has to sit with what risk they're comfortable with. And, you know, potentially the virus is less of a risk than their child's mental health. And in some families where there might be an underlying health condition in their physical health, or, you know, they have an older member of the family living with them and they wouldn't want to expose that older family member, it might be make more sense, you know, to keep that child home. And so I think you have to, you know, kind of assess the situation, sit with it, sit with the people that you love, and decide what's best for your family, and potentially try to, you know, use the data, but and have a really accurate sense of the situation, but then on a guttural level, decide what is going to be best emotionally and what you're comfortable with.
And we're really just embarking on the beginning of this school year. And I can just imagine, you know, you have these threads that you want to continue following up on when it comes to education this year. What are you interested in following as the school year continues?
My deep prayer is that I have alerted families to a situation that could be very chaotic, but that it's not as bad as we think, and that we end up learning that kids and families are more resilient than we're projecting. And that my hope is that I find a lot of threads of positive stories of resilience, of kids that we learned a lot from last year, and that we can apply those lessons going forward into the school year. I mean, I think you and I probably know this. Everyone we could talk to has come through the pandemic. It was hard in some way or another, and you probably learned something, and you're probably a stronger person for it. And I can imagine these kids will be that way too. And hopefully that's what I'll be covering. That's my dream. I'm tired of covering bad news.
Exactly. I'll cross my fingers with you, Leslie. Thank you for sharing your reporting.
Thank you.
Leslie McClurg is a health reporter for KQED in the Bay Area, and she was talking to us about her recent reporting following families dealing with children bringing home COVID-19 from school. Up next, as the Caldor fire continues to burn in El Dorado County, we check in with local wineries on the threat. And a researcher with a background in grape production and winemaking explains the annual smoke and ashes impact on the California wine industry. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Caldor fire continues to threaten El Dorado County, growing to nearly 130,000 acres, producing historic amounts of smoke and ash, which have enveloped wine vineyards across the country. We checked in on wine industry publications, which report, thankfully, that El Dorado County wineries have not reported damages. But the fire is just one threat. The wineries south of Highway 50 have been most impacted, and some have temporarily closed amid evacuations, not to mention the smoke and the ash. One of those is Skinner Vineyards, located in Somerset. Their tasting room is closed due to the Caldor fire. Stephanie Singer with Skinner Vineyards joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
You know, just given how big El Dorado County is and really just a robust community of wine regions, both north and south of Highway 50, can you tell us exactly where your winery is and how people get there?
Sure, absolutely. Our winery is, I always like to say, we're about 18 miles south of the city of Placerville as the crow flies. Or to give people another sort of way to visualize it, we're actually equidistant really between the city of Placerville and the city of Plymouth and Amador County. So when you're traveling from Sacramento, you can access that by traveling up Highway 50 and coming down south through windy, really beautiful foothill roads that feel almost mountainous. Or if you're coming up through Amador County along E16, you continue north into El Dorado County, and we're in this cute little enclave Fairplay that has what we call the Fairplay Loop. And there's over 25 wineries right there in the Fairplay area.
Yeah, it's so surprising when you're talking about Fairplay and neighboring Somerset. I mean, when you look at it, I've driven through there, the wine community in your area just seems so tight-knit.
Absolutely. The wine industry in general, this has been my experience throughout California, and I imagine, you know, throughout the world, is an incredibly tight-knit community because we're agriculture. At the end of the day, we're farmers, and we rely so heavily on what is going on in our little ecosystems and working collaboratively with our neighbors. It's just really important to us that we all work together to watch out for one another. And that's what's made this fire so incredibly difficult for all of us, is to watch our neighbors who are impacted. It's been scary.
Yeah, this wildfire has been burning for a little over a week now and continues to be a threat. Cal Fire said it's the number one wildfire threat in the country earlier this week. How are you all faring right now?
You know, I think a lot of nerves are frayed because it is a threat and it continues to burn in all directions. You know, it's not necessarily burning away from anyone at this point. And we're all just sort of sitting and waiting and watching. There's so many unknowns, and we really won't know the answer to the impact that the fire has on us, both from an agricultural and a wine growing standpoint, as well as when we'll be able to return to our tasting rooms and reopen. So, you know, at this point, like I said, our nerves are a little frayed. We're all just waiting and watching and really trying to stay as optimistic and hope for the best. But on the other hand, we're also seeing the devastation that this fire has caused to neighboring communities. Many of those neighbors are folks who work with us in the industry, and it's just devastating to see so many people in our community displaced and wondering how we can continue to support them and help.
take us back to that moment when y'all decided to close the tasting room.
Well, you know, it was over the weekend, and I personally wasn't there. My tasting room team was up at the winery, one of which who actually lives very close. And I knew that the fire had broken out on Saturday, and Sunday we connected, and they were able to really give me a better picture of how quickly and how close it was to us in Somerset and Fairplay, being on the middle fork of the Cosumnes River there. And while we were talking about the smoke, I think my first thought was just, if it is not safe for you to be there, please go home. There's, you know, nothing that is worth the risk to the safety of our team members. And so that was when we made the decision on Sunday for them to close early. Thankfully, we did, because immediately we started to get evacuation orders from much of the surrounding communities. One of our other team members went right to work helping family members to evacuate. So there just really was no question, if we're in any danger, please go home, take care of your families, and we'll reassess when we have a chance to take a breath and get a better picture of what this fire impact is really going to be on our community.
Yeah, I mean, safety obviously is paramount. On another, I guess on the flip side, looking ahead, I mean, there's going to be a financial impact as well. I mean, what is your concern about potential loss in profit because of this?
Well, one thing that I will say for Skinner, that we've learned so many lessons because of the pandemic this past 18, you know, months, almost 2 years now, in how do we stay in touch with our customers when they can't come to see us? And we've really been fortunate and just so humbled by the support of our wine club members and our other friends who continue to come out, and whether it's, you know, them having the chance to taste with us in person or just hopping online and buying some wine so that we can stay busy and keep everyone, you know, working and active and quite honestly, you know, be able to continue to pay all of our employees. That's been incredible. So we're just going to have to wait and see. We also are thankful and very fortunate that Skinner Vineyards has estate vineyards a little bit closer to the town of El Dorado Hills. And so we have a very small tasting room in the town of Rescue that we're going to be able to open on a really limited basis as we can get wine. Most of our wine is stored in a warehouse up on Mount Ockham Road, right outside of the Fairplay area. So we're going to, you know, it's just a matter of how much wine can we get down once a week at this point. But our hope is that we'll at least be able to see some of our local club members when the air is clear enough for them to come out and pick up their wine and say hi to us.
Oh, that's great to hear, because that was going to be my next question. Is your crop actually going to be impacted in the seasons ahead?
We don't know. I mean, that is really the big question. It is too soon to tell. And I know that you have another guest who can speak with much more detail and much more knowledge about this topic. But it's just a waiting game at this point of how is the crop impacted by the impact of the smoke. We're very thankful to all of the fire crews that have been out there working so hard to protect our region. We still feel really confident that Fairplay is going to be safe from any structural damage and any actual loss in terms of, you know, our vines for long term. But what we don't know is what will the 2021 harvest look like, and will the fruit be damaged because of the smoke exposure? A lot of that is information that sometimes you don't have until the wine's actually made, because it's actually the fermentation process that can alter the chemistry of the wine. So it's still just a waiting game for us to see, to be able to access the fruit and run some of those tests. And, you know, there's even been talk amongst our production team about doing small fermentations and, you know, like buckets to then be able to test the resulting wine, not wine that we would ever do anything with, but just to get an idea of what the impact has been from the fire on any wine that we would make from that fruit.
Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time. And I just wish you and Skinner Vineyards the very best.
Well, we really appreciate having the chance to be on here. And thank you for thinking of all of us up in El Dorado County. We really appreciate it.
Stephanie Singer is with Skinner Vineyards in El Dorado County in the Fair Play area. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The Caldor Fire is just one of multiple active wildfires in California. And the smoke, the expansive smoke, is visible from NASA satellites. The vast hazard of air quality on wine grapes is once again jeopardizing the state's beloved and celebrated wine industry. This threat has become a nearly annual occurrence, and one that UC Davis studies, home to its own school of grape production and winemaking. Our next guest studies the effects of the smoke and ash on wine crops, and actually has described the smoky taste in wine as licking an ashtray. Anita Oberholster is a cooperative extension enology specialist at UC Davis. Welcome to Insight and for the very visual description.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you for having me. Yes, you know, if you can imagine what that would be like, you have a pretty good description of what we would call classical smoke taint. But in the extreme case, you know, you get various expressions of smoke exposure, but that would be the extreme case. That would be a very accurate description.
You know, I've actually interviewed you in years past on site at UC Davis on this very issue. Did you envision what feels like just an annual impact on our wide-reaching wine region?
Unfortunately, this has been expected. We think this is part of our ecology in the future, something that we will just need to learn to manage. But you know, you always hope, you always have your fingers crossed, and we all hope that this is going to be a really boring year with, you know, no extremes, no fires, no any natural disasters. But unfortunately, here we are again.
Given that your focus is research, what has surprised you most during this period when it comes to this issue of smoke and ash affecting the wine crop?
You know, it's interesting. Last year, the smoke exposure was really widespread. It impacted most of the wine grape growing areas, including our own vineyards here at UC Davis. And I did a lot of experiments last year, and our grapes were actually not impacted.
So what actually leads to that? That's a happy surprise. Exactly. What led to that, you think?
You know, this is the thing. It's very difficult at this point of time for us to predict risk. Everybody wants to know, you know, my phone is ringing off the hook. How far do I need to be away from the fire to be safe? And unfortunately, there's not a number, because it's really less about proximity than how fresh was the smoke when it got to you. You have vineyards that's right next to a fire, but the wind direction, the topography is such that it isn't really highly impacted, where another vineyard is 20 miles away, but directly in the way of the column of smoke, you know, and the wind direction, and way more impacted. So, you know, what we learned from last year is that we didn't get fresh smoke here. It took a couple of days. It was heavy. It hanged around for at least a week. High AQI, you know, air quality index, and we're not impacted. So it's sort of good news, right? And not so good for all the research I was doing in the vineyard, but it tells me that really fresh smoke, that's our main concern. So far, really bad news. My heart goes out to the people in El Dorado County, because obviously I am concerned. They're really close to the fires. Some of them will be exposed to fresh smoke. And we see that as something that's less than 24 hours old. So I add there do have risk. Wineries and vineyards there do have some risk. Those currently that's further away, even here in the Sacramento area, Yolo County, now Sonoma County, I'm cautiously optimistic, because most of the smoke took a while to get here, at least, you know, a day or two. So we hope that at least the impact so far are way, way less than last year.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You know, when learning more about fresh smoke, which is within 24 hours, you know, I'm going to still ask it. I guess, how do consecutive years of wildfire smoke and ash, does it compound the risk at all?
No, not at all. So, you know, that's the silver lining. Vines are really resilient. You know, while they're in the smoke, they shut down a little bit, but they come back. The moment the air's clear, they come back and they thrive again. It's only the heat itself and actual burning that can obviously damage them more long term. And, you know, there's no overly season. It basically, the compounds that causes what we call smoke that in the wine gets absorbed onto the leaves and onto the grapes themselves. These things don't overwinter, right? So next season, you're starting afresh. There is no long-term impact that we're currently aware of for continual exposure or, you know, every year exposure.
What about the timing of a wildfire when you're looking at the maturity of a grape? If it's happening during harvest season, is that a good or a bad thing?
No, that's a bad thing. So at this stage, there's a lot of, we need to do so much more research. We used to say, okay, from very early on, that is when you get sugar accumulation in the fruit, when you see red grapes turning red. We said from then to harvest, it's when grapes are the most sensitive. But Australia, for instance, they many times are exposed to wildfire smoke at their vineyards much earlier in the growing season. And last year, they had instances of grapes that were rock hard, like little peas, and were still highly impacted. But, you know, if you have enough smoke exposure, then you will get some impact. But yes, I would say as the skin soften, they probably get a little bit more sensitive to smoke exposure. We know there's even varietal differences. We just don't have enough data to really have good risk assessment. This is really where we're focusing for the future as far as research goes.
Yeah, how does extreme heat and drought factor into this conversation?
Oh, it's just more challenges for the grape and wine industry as we don't have enough. You know, obviously, the drier it is out there, the more risk you have of wildfires. So that is a real concern. Always with droughts, you have just another stress, something else for the grape grower to worry about. You know, access to water. And the drier your vineyard, the drier the surrounding areas, the higher the risk for a fire to start and to spread very quickly, unfortunately. And, you know, heat just compounds it.
Yeah. You know, going off of that, there's been some dramatic headlines out there. One from Nat Geo comes to mind from last wildfire season, warning that Northern California's wine country is at risk of being wiped out due to wildfires and climate change. I mean, do you put any weight behind that? That's a pretty bold headline.
That is a pretty bold headline. I think that is a very pessimistic headline. You know, we have a lot of things we can do. We're very resilient. The industry is really working together to find solutions. Every year, we are a little bit more prepared for the challenges that we face. Yes, last year, I would say, was unprecedented with the, you know, how much of the wine country was impacted by the wildfires. So far this year, it's mostly Northern, you know, El Dorado County and higher that was somewhat impacted. You know, the industry is big. So I do feel that we will always be able to produce some really good quality wine. And like I said, even in El Dorado County, there could be areas there that would be just fine. We just don't know. It's really hard to predict. But yes, you know, climate change, it is getting hotter, but there's varieties that's more resilient to heat. We have canopy management that we can change, water management that we can optimize. We have things like shade cloth to make your grapes cooler. We have a lot of tools that we can still use to produce good quality wines for at least the next century.
Given that we have winemakers in a wine region where many people are currently evacuated and they're worried, what advice do you have for wine growers and winemakers when it comes to this?
I think be prepared for worst case scenario. I mean, we just now have to be where you need to have a plan. Like you have an evacuation plan, you need to have a plan. Okay, if the fires arrive, what's my next steps? What do I do? What do I do in the vineyard? What do I do in the winery? You know, if you have wine in your winery, just try and seal them, protect them as well as you can, and they may be fine. If you have grapes in the vineyard and you're able to harvest them as soon as you can and process them as soon as you can. You know, I do think things like crop insurance is becoming an essential item now. You know, it's a band-aid, but it helps. I think preparedness, you know, and open conversations and communication between grape growers and wineries about expectations. What do we do if we, suspect that there may be potential smoke impact? What should that conversation look like? How did we make picking decisions? How do we decide whether the quality of the wine was impacted or not? And just, you know, keep up with the science. We try and get information out there as soon as we learn anything new that can be useful to the industry. I mean, we needed the information 5 years ago. That is the truth. And unfortunately, research is slow. I'm also telling people, you know, take baseline data. If you see something coming or fire coming, smoke coming, just grab some grapes, throw it in the freezer so that you have numbers. You know what was baseline without smoke exposure. It gives you something to compare with when you need to get these, you know, analytical data and make decisions about picking. It's really hard when you don't know what is naturally present in the grapes to know what was elevated and how much was the impact. And, you know, and we do, like the winemaker said, you know, making wines sometimes is the best way to know. Making small scale wines, evaluating the wines, your sensory organs are actually very, very sensitive. And you can taste smoke impact quite clearly. And sometimes that is more informative than the analytical data, even though you do need those data points as well, especially, you know, for contracts and for insurance purposes.
Well, thank you so much, Anita, for sharing your research and joining us this morning.
My pleasure, as always.
Anita Oberholster is a Cooperative Extension Enology Specialist at UC Davis. Still ahead, Cap Radio Jazz sits down with musician Roger Smith of Tower of Power. The legendary Oakland soul band is heading to Yolo County to perform at the Old Sugar Mill in Clarksburg on Friday. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Tower of Power, the legendary soul band from Oakland, has been teaching us all what is hip for half a century. The band is celebrating its silver anniversary this year with a new CD and a return to live performances, including a stop Friday night at the Old Sugar Mill in Clarksburg. Here's a taste of their 1973 release, What is Hip?
What is hip? Tell me if you think you know what is hip. If you're really hip, the passing of years will show you in a hip trip, maybe hipper than hip. What is hip?
Cynthia and Chris are bouncing around in the booth. I could see them through the glass window. Well, Cap Radio Jazz music director Gary Fergeli recently sat down with the group's organist since 1999, Sacramento Land Park resident and local music icon, Roger Smith.
No one lays down a funky groove better than Sacramento's own Roger Smith. This master of the keyboards had a number one hit on the smooth jazz charts in the late 1990s while simultaneously playing organ with the legendary soul band Tower of Power, a job he's held for more than two decades. Any band that stays together for 50 years is bound to face health issues. In 2017, two key members of the group were seriously injured in a train accident near Yoshi's nightclub in Oakland. Both required lengthy hospital stays. When I asked Roger how their absence affected the band, he said they stayed positive during their convalescence. He then reflected on some health concerns of his own.
I was diagnosed with prostate cancer and given a year, 6 months quality life. That was 15, 17 years ago. All three of the big major urology specialists, that was their thing, prostate cancer. And the first diagnosis, of course, was very emotional. It kind of set me back. You know, somebody's going to tell you, okay, you'll be alive for another year, 6 months, you'll be fine. Get your stuff together. Basically, that's what I was told. My outlook was a very positive and aggressively positive attitude toward it. This isn't going to get me. This isn't going to stop me from living. And it's not going to stop me from pursuing what I want to pursue. Having said that, I'm still here. Life is what you make it. Yeah, come on. You can bend, but do not break it. Don't break it, y'all. Don't break it no more, no. Life is what you make it. Yeah. So make it funky. Several years ago, Roger's band was playing a gig in Lake Tahoe, and Tower of Power was playing down the street. Drummer Dave Garibaldi and other TLP members came to check him out and stayed for both sets. Shortly after that, the band's agent called Roger and invited him to audition in Los Angeles. Roger, not wanting to travel at his own expense just for the possibility of getting hired, politely declined. About 2 weeks later, I get a call from Dave Garibaldi, and he says, "Hey, man, would you mind coming to my house?" He lives in Livermore. Me, Jeff, and Rocco, we can just jam, okay? Sure. I was very enthused about that. So I took all my stuff and went down to his house, set it up. We jammed. We had a good time playing and had a good camaraderie. I'm sitting in the kitchen. I think I was drinking a beer. Dave offered me some kind of libation. And he gets on the phone right by me. He calls Emilio and tells Emilio, "We got our organ player." And the rest is history. Well, these tunes, they're set up rhythmically to where it has to be precise. Every part that you play has to intertwine with the horns, the vocals, the guitar. Everything has a space. Now, we all know the way Dave Garibaldi plays. He's a rhythmical genius, and he is an innovator of a specific sound. That sound is Tower of Power between him and Rocco. That was my most daunting task, to find my voice in there. Where does Roger fit in? That was the most difficult part for me, trying not to overdo it. For about a year that I was in the band, everybody was scratching their heads. I don't think this guy is going to make it, you know, because I was overplaying a lot. But I didn't realize it. It didn't settle in for a long time until we actually got in the studio to do one of the records. And I said, "Oh, man, no, that's not going to work. So how do I do this?" And it took a while to listen to the guitar. Okay, between him and the bass, man, okay, there's a spot. And I found my spot. It took a while to find my piece of the puzzle, if you will.
Although the members of the band now live in several different states, they all come together for life on the road.
When you're touring with 14 people in this rolling juggernaut, with grown men, not boys, you know, I think everybody is real aware of the next guy. You know, everybody's aware of everybody's space, and everybody knows just where to make it down the middle. You grow up in this life having done just about everything you can think of in the music, you know, drug, sex, rock and roll thing.
and you come out of it on the other side, first of all, you're grateful that you made it to the other side. Now, what's going to keep me on the other side? This is what I've learned. Okay, focus. Kind to my brother over here. You know, if I have an issue, all right, if you're over here on the left, I'm over here on the right. How can we kind of bring it to the middle? How can we talk about this so we can keep our common ground? And that's what we've all learned how to do, to take left and right and bring it right to the middle, to keep it going down the road.
Roger is no stranger to the road. Before joining Tower of Power, the Land Park resident had already toured the world backing major artists including Jeff Beck, Gladys Knight, Willie Nelson, and Leon Russell. It was during these tours that Roger got exposed to fine wines, leading to a lifelong passion. 9 years ago, Roger and his longtime friend Mike Smolich founded Bump City Winery in Clarksburg. Named after T.O.P.'s second album, this boutique label sources grapes from Sonoma and Lodi and has already won numerous awards. Their Rhone-style wines reflect Roger's personal taste for a smooth, appealing wine.
Running the winery, like I say, it's a passion too, and it's also a learning process because I spend a lot of time with our winemaker and with a lot of the other old winemakers that I know up in Amador. And just watching their craft, watching them do it, and understanding this business of wine that I'm in. I pretty much stand aside and just watch, take notes, listen, and do a lot of reading. Then I do my own experimentation, you know, my own side by side. My thing was to make the best wine I could make. I wanted my wine to be the focus. I didn't want Tower of Power to be the focus. I wanted the wine to be the focus, you know. So I never put out or marketed, you know, black-owned winery. I didn't want to go there. I wanted to set the story and get it established from the ground up as being a very good winery, a very good run company. And it kind of balances out. You know, it's not all about what's it like or how did you do this or what brought you into it. It's like, I love this wine. Oh, and you're in Tower? Then it's the conversation goes on. So I'm really happy about that because the first 4 years, I kept that on the down low. We just worked to make good wine.
And the name Bump City?
It's the Oakland Hills, and also there's so many variations. Bump City, you know, started off, you know, right there on MacArthur, you know, where the old clubs used to be. It's where Tower Power started. And also the old elevated freeway on 880. You know, a lot of kids were under there doing things they shouldn't be doing back in the day. And then trucks would go over and you just kind of shake and you rattle and roll. And so you talk to your friends, hey, man, what are you doing tonight? I don't know, head over to Bump City. You going to meet me over there? There you go.
For Insight, I'm Gary Vicelli.
Tower of Power featuring organist Roger Smith will bring their swinging, horn-intensive sound to the Old Sugar Mill in Clarksburg Friday night from 4 to 9 p.m. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.